Welcome to you all this evening. It's my pleasure to both chair and give you a proper welcome to this second panel discussion hosted by the Centre for the Study of Human Rights. This evening's topic is Human Rights in the 21st Century, the Case of China. And it gives me a special pleasure to be here chairing this event tonight because I'm the Deputy Director responsible for Research and External Relations at the LSE. And in that capacity, having oversight of the LSE's external relations, I have some sort of responsibility for our relationships as an institution with Chinese university institutions. So was the cause of my first and my second visit to China. So I'll be quite interested to hear what emerges tonight in the discussion. We've got three speakers here tonight, and I'll introduce them in a minute. And the plan is that they will each speak for 15 minutes. I won't let them go for any longer. And then we'll open the floor for questions, and we'll have 40 minutes, perhaps a little less, for questions from the audience. This topic of human rights and China is an interesting one and a very controversial one. China is very, very much in the news because it presents a picture pretty much of an economic miracle. Growth rate is huge. China's role as a global player is obviously on the rise. Its expansion into overseas markets and its fast-developing diplomatic engagement all give us pause for a bit of wonderment, I suppose, and sometimes a bit of concern. It is, or is certainly well on the way to being, a global superpower. But the more China emerges into the limelight, the more questions are raised about its approach to human rights. You can see the tensions everywhere. You only have to open the newspapers each day, and you can see discussions raised on both sides of the debate about China's approach to human rights. And what we want to do tonight is give you, a better informed perspective, and certainly some particular angles on those debates about China's human rights. I'm going to introduce the speakers in alphabetical order, and that's the order in which they're going to speak, although that's by coincidence rather than by design. So starting on my immediate left and then going along the row, first of all, Brad Adams. I'm quite pleased that some of these people are LSE alumni and alumna. Brad is an LSE alumnus. He's a lawyer trained at Berkeley. He's currently the director of the Human Rights Watch Asia Division and previously worked for 5 years in Cambodia for the UN, where he was in charge of their human rights office. Next to him, Bruce Gilley is an assistant professor of political studies at Queen's University in Canada, and he's the author of a book, China's Democratic Future: How Will It Happen and Where Will It Lead? He spent 10 years reporting on China and Asia for the Far Eastern Economic Review before returning to Princeton to do a PhD. He's a participant in the National Endowment for Democracy Project, which is on democratization in China, and he's lectured widely on democracy in China. And then on his left is Yi Yi Lu, an LSE alumna. She's an associate fellow at Chatham House and is currently leading a project on civil society and environmental governance in China. She's previously worked for several international institutions and development organizations in China, including the United Nations Development Fund for Women, the Ford Foundation, and Save the Children UK. She did her PhD here at the LSE and also studied at the University of Pennsylvania and Peking University in Beijing. So can I first of all get Brad Adams here? 15 minutes, Brad.
thank you to the LSC, and thank you for the introduction. I think the first thing that's worth discussing in any public debate about China is the question of universality of human rights standards. And I just want to say that I think that we're past this debate. In the 1990s, there was a raging debate about whether there was something that one could call Asian values that somehow separated what it meant to have rights if you were an Asian and what it meant to have rights if you were from some other part of the world. That debate has more or less been given up by its proponents, which were largely the Chinese government, the Singaporean government, and the Malaysian government. It simply doesn't stand the test of reality. If you go to a village in Cambodia where I worked, or Thailand where I work now, or Pakistan, Afghanistan, China, any place in which I work, if people feel like they are being mistreated, they express it, they feel very unhappy about it, and they think it's wrong. And that doesn't change whether you're in China or somewhere else. So the idea that somehow Asian countries care more about social stability and the group than the individual is actually not borne out when you actually go and talk to people individually. The people who say that are people in power and people who have privileges. That debate sometimes works its way, that discussion sometimes works its way into discussions about human rights in China, but much less so now. And in fact, what the Chinese actually tend to say now is something a little bit more traditional, which is others should not interfere in the internal affairs of our country. We don't interfere in the internal affairs of your country, which is a staple of Chinese foreign policy, although it's starting to change. And you shouldn't interfere in the internal affairs of our country. In other words, sovereignty is the rule. And I think all of you will know that all international human rights treaties and principles are based on the idea that sovereignty really doesn't matter. Human rights standards protect individuals no matter where they are located, with some exceptions in international law. I also think it's important not to get into a debate about what the human rights situation in China is, although maybe that will happen tonight. And I'll go through some examples of why I think the human rights situation is critical in China and why the trajectory, sadly, is negative these days. I think the more interesting debate is, what would people of good faith and goodwill do about the human rights situation in China, given China's history, given the political environment of China, given the fact that it's still a one-party state? That's a much more interesting question about which people of good faith can differ. But there really is no serious argument about the fact that there's a critical human rights situation in China. In fact, I rarely encounter such claims, except from the Chinese Foreign Ministry, which dismisses all of our press releases and reports with a wave of the arm and saying that, you know, these are biased, untrue attacks on China. I think what confounds the discussion is that there is more or less something that I would call an A China and a B China. And this is different. In the past, there was simply a B China. What I mean by A China and B China is that there is definitely a very large group of people who are seeing improvements in their welfare, in their standard of living, and even in their individual human rights situation. These are the winners in China's reform process. Anyone who talks about human rights, as I do regularly on China, has to acknowledge that on the ground, in a day-to-day life in China, things have improved in the personal sphere. It wasn't very long ago that having a private conversation with somebody where one criticized the government, even in one's own home, was a risky affair. Where if you met college students at Beijing Normal University or somewhere else, you met them as a tourist at the Winter Palace, wherever you went, people would be quite nervous to talk to you. They certainly wouldn't talk to foreign journalists. They probably wouldn't talk to Chinese journalists. And they lived in a generalized atmosphere of fear. That is not the case anymore, largely. People complain about the Chinese government all the time. They complain about the Communist Party all the time. All you have to do is look at Chinese blogs to realize the extent to which personal freedom of expression has improved, and how much of a sea change there has been. And I would say that's happened all in the last 10 years. I mean, 10 years ago, my personal experience being in Beijing on a cold spring day at the Winter Palace, running into some Chinese university students, they were absolutely petrified to have a conversation about politics. I tried to bring it up. They all sort of tittered, walked away, and tried to get away from me as fast as they could. That's not reality anymore in China. But there is a B China. And the B China are all the people who are left out of all the economic modernization. I wouldn't quite call it a miracle, because there are a lot of losers in China. And this actually is one of the main causes of social unrest, the fact that there are people who are getting poorer, both in absolute terms and certainly in relative terms. There's a huge amount of resentment in the country, looking at all the people who are doing extremely well, the many millionaires, and in fact, you can read profiles fairly regularly now of billionaires in China, and the fact that this wealth is not being evenly distributed. At the same time, you have a one-party state that still says it's a socialist party and that socialism is prevailing. A lot of people can't process this. It makes no sense to them. So there's huge resentment. Just to give you one example, last year the Chinese government reported there were 84,000 public protests in the country. These are government figures which are very unlikely to be an underestimate. So there were probably a lot more than that. There were 78,000 the year before. Unrest is widespread. It's all over the country. And the Chinese government and the Communist Party of China have one main goal, which is to contain it. They need to find a way, a device, to stay in power and to contain dissent. And thus far, they've done fairly well, although depending on whether you see things in an optimistic or pessimistic vein, you could make a strong case that they're not doing as well as it seems from the outside. So what are the main human rights problems in China? Well, you can go to our website, you can go to Amnesty's website, you can go to Human Rights in China's website and get a full understanding of that. Let me just sort of talk about one aspect that I think is critical, and that has everything to do with the possibilities of reform, and that is essentially activism. If you pick any subject in China where there's a critical social or human rights problem, there are activists now pursuing that issue. Let's take forced evictions. Beijing is going through a huge redevelopment scheme right now to prepare the city for the 2008 Olympics. Whole neighborhoods are being knocked down, and there are cultural preservationists who are horrified by this. There are people in favor of economic development, think it's the best thing that's ever happened to Beijing. But the face of Beijing is completely changed. And there are people who are losing in this process, of course, as there are in any major economic restructurings. And one problem is that people are being forcibly evicted from their homes without due process, without proper compensation. And essentially, the poor are being shoved out of Beijing into rural poverty. There's no legal process for most people involved in this. So what do? Well, at first they organize at the neighborhood level, then they organize at the village level, and then they bring their case to the Beijing and national authorities, often through a device called petitioning. We published a report on the petitioning movement last year. Now, petitioning is one device that the Chinese Communist Party and the state use as a pressure release valve. And I'll come back to this point. What petitioners can do, it's an age-old process, is to have a lot of people sign a document saying, we all share the same problem, please fix it. It's essentially going to a people in authority on your knees and saying, please, we've run out of options, solve our problem. Now, that process, according to the Chinese officials, works in 2% of cases. There's been a study by the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences which says that it succeeds in 2% of the cases. In many more cases, the people who do this are harassed, beaten, or imprisoned. Take HIV/AIDS. A huge amount of progress has been made on HIV/AIDS in recent years. Until 5 years ago, China was much like America under Ronald Reagan. The leadership of China never mentioned the fact that HIV/AIDS existed in the country. Hu Jintao broke that silence. So that's very positive. The Chinese government is now committed to retrovirals, access to retrovirals for people who are HIV positive. And a lot of money is being poured into it. They're working with the Gates Foundation and others to make that a reality. But people who band together and complain about the way that the Chinese government is executing its policies, complain about discrimination, which is still rampant, complain about the treatment of injection drug users, which is usually very violent, which is often very violent, are often beaten up. Some of them are in prison. Often their projects are closed. A project called Snow Lotus in Xinjiang was recently closed because the leader of the project complained about 19 hepatitis B positive people, students in Xinjiang, and the way they were excluded from school. Perhaps the most important form of organized opposition, which involves activism now, is the internet. China is investing billions of dollars to keep information away from Chinese citizens. Employs somewhere between 50 and 100,000 people to build its great firewall and to keep its great firewall functional. And as I'm sure there's plenty of tech-savvy people in this room, you will know it's actually much easier to go around a firewall than it is to plug the holes in it. So it takes a lot of resources, a lot of money and people to keep the firewall plugged. Mirror sites and other circumvention techniques are very common in China. But the Chinese authorities are terrified of the organizing principle that the internet presents for activism and for dissent. So they're systematically plugging these holes. So one can talk about Xinjiang, one can talk about Tibet, one can talk about Mongolia, one can talk about labor rights. There are serious human rights problems in all those areas. I think the most important question to address is, what is the trajectory? Are things getting better or are things getting worse? 2 years ago, if I had stood here, I would have said the trajectory is relatively positive. I would have identified a range of problems. I would have said they were serious. I would have said they required intervention from outside and a serious commitment from the Chinese government. But I would have said that there was a tenuous but positive trajectory. That's all changed. And this is very disappointing because there was an expectation with generational change at the leadership level of the Chinese Communist Party that possibly some of the outdated thinking that has characterized Chinese policy in the past would have changed. But we now can say with absolute clarity that the leadership of President Hu Jintao and the Prime Minister Wen is not a reformist leadership. One can have lots of discussions about why that might be, what the limitations might be. One can impute motives, whether they actually wish they could be reformers but are boxed in by hardliners. But the fact is, they are not carrying out any signs of a reformist agenda. And in fact, things are getting much worse. And the main place where this is obvious is on activism. The reason why things seemed like they were getting better a couple of years ago, and this was over a period of a few years, was because there had been an explosion in activism, an explosion in dissent. Things that were unimaginable in the Chinese media were becoming routine. Stories about corruption, stories about torture. And the Chinese government was taking action against these things. Now, one can question what their motives were for taking action. Were they to reform the system or were they to protect the system? And that never was clear. But now, people who are being a little bit too noisy, a little bit too loud, are finding themselves in jail. And not because I'm a lawyer do I say this, but the class of people now who are the newest persecuted bunch, which I think shows just how deep-seated the malaise is, are lawyers. It was until very recently the case that people who represented other people who were in a disfavored class were more or less left alone to do it. They might have to be careful with the media. They kind of knew that there were lines in the sand, but they could vigorously defend their clients and take up whole classes of outcast people, whether they're people with HIV/AIDS or they're petitioners or they're people trying to start unions or even democracy activists. Those very same people now are actually becoming targets themselves. You may have heard about the blind lawyer who was recently given a lengthy jail sentence for obstructing traffic in a city, in a patently absurd charge. There is a laundry list of people who had started to get some notoriety who have been chopped down. They've put their heads above the parapet, and they're systematically being knocked down. To the point that there are very few people in the Chinese legal community who are willing to take on difficult cases now. It is very, very dangerous. This is a dramatic turn of events and a dramatic setback. Why is the Chinese government doing this? Well, I have a couple of minutes to posit some theories. First of all, the Chinese government is terrified that activists and workers, and this is the same as was true in 1989 when Tiananmen Square happened, that activists and workers will get together and form political movements, whether at a local level, a provincial level, or a national level. So the first aim of Chinese policy is to break any of those possibilities up. And the greatest organizing principle for that has been the internet. So one main purpose of the Great Firewall and having a very proactive policy of censorship, which is public, it's not a theory, it's announced, and the resources they're putting into it are fairly public, is to make sure that doesn't happen. The Chinese government is terrified of the color revolutions that have occurred in the last 12, 18 months. They talk about it all the time inside the party. It's in the Chinese press. They are not going to allow those things to happen in China. They're very concerned about the precedent that's been set in places where they've had color revolutions. But I would also posit that the international environment has enabled the Chinese government to do what they're doing. China mesmerizes a lot of people. Whether it's the market, whether it's the possibility they're going to become a superpower, whether it's the size of the population, the rest of the world is now on the back foot. Just to give you an example, if you take yourself back 5 years or 10 years, the first item on the agenda of any summit between the U.S. president and the Chinese president, the British prime minister and the Chinese president, the German chancellor and the Chinese president, pick your country, was human rights. If you look carefully now at communiques after summits, or if you look at the agendas that are announced before summits, human rights is never the first item, and it's often an afterthought. I happen to know that the last time President Bush met the Chinese president, that the communique mentioned human rights at the end, made it sound like, well, maybe a third of the discussion was about human rights. It was 5 minutes. What message does that send to the Chinese leadership? Very strong one. Look at the way that Yahoo, Google, and Microsoft have behaved in China. The Chinese government has more or less tamed other powers in the world who want to do business with it, who don't bring up human rights anymore. And now, and recently, they've tamed the major information providers in the world whose mission in life is to disseminate information. And they've turned Google into a censor. Google set up a Chinese website where they actively censor their own website. And I want to make this point very clear, because it's actually important to understand what the dynamics are here internationally. The Chinese government does not go to Google and say, here are 1,000 words that you must censor, or 1,000 search terms that you must censor. Google uses predictive technology, predictive searching, to figure out what the Chinese firewall is bouncing back. And after a series of tests, they take down those items. So you get a blank error page if you try to search for those items. That's what Google is doing itself. Why is Google doing this? And you think to yourself, the founders of Google, those people are billionaires. They've got it made. Why would they ever make such an accommodation? Well, it's the allure of the Chinese market. It's their sense that if they don't get in there, someone else will, and they'll be left behind. And that would be a disaster as far as they're concerned. I should say I'm in regular touch with Google and Yahoo and Microsoft, for that matter, and there are huge arguments inside these companies, but bottom line is they've all done it. They've all capitulated. So they've seen off major powers, they've seen off major companies, and there's one other element about why this is the case. Condoleezza Rice was in Beijing just a couple of days ago. Was she discussing human rights? Was she discussing the internal political situation in China? No. China is growing as a power. She was there to ask for a foreign policy favor from China. She went there to talk about North Korea. In other cases, they'll be talking to the Chinese about Iran. The United States has pushed China very hard on Burma, to its credit. But the dynamics of the relationship have changed dramatically. And I'll finish with this point. Every Chinese human rights activist, in fact, every Chinese person concerned about the human rights situation in China, has told me, as they tell everyone like me, that the only way things are going to change in China is from external pressure. Now, that may change someday. I always say, look, you know, you never know who thought the Soviet Union was going to break up 2 years before it did. There are all sorts of internal dynamics, but people feel very isolated, under siege, under threat, and they really believe, and I think there's empirical reasons to believe this, that only international pressure will help change things in China. And we're failing them. From the outside, the world is failing Chinese people. And I just want to add one caveat to the last point, which is people say, well, you know, it's important to get Chinese on board on business, on foreign policy, and well, you know, that may be the price. It's the price for 1.2 billion people. It's not the price for some small country where you could rationalize that not that many people are being hurt. A huge number of people's lives are being affected by external policy towards China. Thank you very much.
Brought pictures. Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here. I guess I'm going to offer a slightly different, not so much interpretation of the right situation in China, so much as ask an obvious question about it, which is this regime with such a rights record as it is, why is it so popular domestically? Why do the Chinese people think that a regime with such a rights record is doing such a good job overall? And when I was thinking about this, it did strike me that China really has become synonymous with really egregious human rights abuses. And among the many sites that have been censored, one of the websites that are unavailable in China, one of them was actually a joke site. And it has on it a picture of a no honking your car horn sign from Beijing. And if you've ever been to China, they adopted a lot of their traffic signs in the 1920s and the 30s when the nationalists and the Japanese were setting up their road system. And the no honking your horn sign is a rather stylized horn, you know, with kind of swirls and stops and whatnot. And on the joke site, there's a picture of this sign, and it says, well, at least in the United States, we can play our trumpets anywhere and anytime we want. And the ability of people to see the Chinese regime as, you know, being such a bad abuser that it actually bans trumpet playing, I think symbolizes why this debate has become so important, which is China is looming as the sort of the Soviet Union of our times. And there's two, I think, reasons why this question gets so much attention. One is, as Brad has alluded to, the China is a growing international presence economically and diplomatically. So that's a good reason to care about this. But the other reason, which I was going to call the puzzle that I'm trying to explain in this talk, is that this regime is domestically very popular. And I actually think that's the reason why this debate has become so important, because it is a puzzle. In North Korea, Saudi Arabia, Burma, the regimes have an equally bad record, but it's quite clear that those regimes are deeply illegitimate. Not so in China, and that's the sort of puzzle I'm going to try and unravel in this talk. So let me just throw a graph at you here. This is a regression line that plots a country's record on democracy, human rights, measured using World Bank Institute indicators on the x-axis on the bottom. All the dots represent individual countries, against their measured legitimacy, which is a composite index, a World Value Survey, Asia Barometer, and behavioral data on tax and voting and political violence. Okay. Now, China is indicated, as you see, really the biggest single outlier of these 72 countries, which is to say, given its rights record, its legitimacy is far, far higher than one would expect. The other dot to the right of it is Azerbaijan. So that is the question, and I think that's really one of the things we're trying to unravel here. Why is that true? I'm going to talk about five different hypotheses. One which I call the fear hypothesis, one which I call Asian values that Brad's talked about, one which I call legacies, one which I call trade-offs, and the last one which is called performance. Fear. The fear hypothesis says the legitimacy is in fact not as high in China as attitudinal and behavioral data would suggest. According to this view, if you're honest with a pollster or an attitudes survey research team about what you actually think, you'll soon find your head in the vice grip formed by the Ministry of Public Security's patent leather shoes and the pavement stones of Tiananmen Square, as this gentleman faced. Fellow citizens will notice and adjust their behavior accordingly. So if this hypothesis is right, then the puzzle kind of resolves itself. You know, China, on that graph I just showed you, comes way down on legitimacy, and it's actually a pretty typical country. Bad human rights, bad legitimacy. I think this is not true. Several people who research public opinion in China and been working on it for more than a decade, like Xu Tianjian at Duke University, have done very careful studies of asking people and trying to tap into people's sense of whether they will face retribution for giving honest answers. And I think the general findings from several different projects have been that while this may have been a factor in the immediate post-Tiananmen period, it's not today. People are, in fact, relatively free to say whatever they want, especially in public opinion surveys. And in fact, the Chinese government is probably the most assiduous surveyor of public attitudes today, and they need people to give honest opinions. So this is a kind of an accepted practice, and it's normal to speak your mind. So I don't think the fear hypothesis is right. Asian values. Well, Asian values, performance, this hypothesis is that rights performance, as measured by something like the World Bank Institute indicator or the Freedom House indicator, is actually not that bad in the eyes of the Chinese people. In fact, their whole conception of rights is completely different. And when you adjust for their conception of rights, what the regime does is actually high-performance rights. So on this thesis, they're really all Confucians at heart, and whenever the world's gaze is turned away, they dress up in Confucian robes like this and parade around ancestral halls. Or maybe they go to the LSE's soon-to-open Confucius Institute, sponsored by the Chinese government. Now, at times, the Chinese government does seem to advocate this view, but I think, as Brad rightly pointed out, this discourse has disappeared. And I think more to the point about what I'm talking about is attitude surveys that have tapped into the Chinese conception of rights, which is, say, you say, what do you think of when you hear Renquan, human rights? What conceptions come to mind? Almost perfectly mirror international responses in putting individual freedom as the main conception that they relate to human rights. So I think the Asian values survey, Asian values hypothesis, as Brad has suggested, is largely false. However, there are some democratic orientations in China which remain more authoritarian than other countries. And here's two bar charts, which are kind of mystery bar charts because I don't tell you which color means what, but I'll tell you. The pink responses are agreement with the statement. The green is disagreement, and the blue is don't know or didn't answer. Okay, so here's one typical question asked in 1993 and 2002. The government should decide whether certain ideas should be discussed in society. This is a type of question that is asked to try and tap into people's authoritarian orientations. Still fairly high in China, even in 2002. International averages on agreement with this statement tend to be more in the 20 to 30% range, but a fairly marked decline. Here's another question, which really taps into Confucianism. If we have public leaders who are morally upright, they can decide everything. Again, Chinese attitudes tend to be slightly more authoritarian, but again, and quite markedly here, there's been a very great change in this value orientation in China in the last 10 years. And of course, the 2002 survey is now 4 years out of date, and all the evidence from the latest round of the World Value Survey is a continued very rapid change in value orientations of China. In other words, whatever was true in the 1990s is much less true today. And Chinese conceptions of rights and of democracies are coming into line with international averages. I think the Asian Values hypothesis, to the extent that it's true, it's weakly true, and probably not very important to explaining the puzzle. Legacies. This also involves a kind of upward revision of the regime's rights record. But in this case, the revision is not because of a different understanding of rights, but because of the view the Chinese people adjust their measurement or their evaluation of rights to take into account certain burdens or legacies that their government has faced. One of them, of course, is the fact that it's a poor country. And we know that income levels and rights performance go hand in hand. And I think EE will talk a little bit about that. I mean, there is a kind of developmental issue with rights, which is the richer you are, the better you're able to provide for rights. China is a poor country. The other one has to do more with history, which is that China went through really the worst 30 years that any country has any experienced from 49 until the end of the Cultural Revolution. Mao's legacy in China is deep, and it tore at the fabric of society. It destroyed their institutions. And that might be another reason to sort of adjust the performance. Yes, it's not great, but it sure is a lot better than it was. And that's a kind of legacy argument again. The problem, again, with this is that survey evidence refutes this, that when you ask people about how they evaluate the rights performance and ask the importance of these things, you get answers that don't relate their performance to those legacies, but relate their performance to comparative experiences of other countries. The Chinese these days have televisions. They know what's going on in the rest of the world, in spite of their government's attempts to often prevent them from knowing that. They know what it means to be democratic. They know what it means to have a proper trial. They know what freedom of information means, and they properly evaluate their government's performance. So, and of course, officially also, there's a kind of government line, at least from certain ministries, that rejects this. The Ministry of Civil Affairs, which runs elections in China, has described as lazy man's logic the idea that poor countries cannot have democratic elections. Trade-offs. Trade-offs and performance are both a similar explanation in that they both argue that the record of the regime on rights is bad, but its record on other things that people may consider as important when making an all-things-considered evaluation of the legitimacy of the regime is quite good. Now, the trade-offs argument is a particular type of that, which is to say that that bad rights performance is necessary for the good performance on other dimensions. This was, of course, the argument made after Tiananmen Square, which these pictures are from, by Jiang Zemin, the then party secretary of the Communist Party. Had it not been our decisive measures taken in Tiananmen Square, he said, China's current prosperity would have been impossible. I remember that Agence France-Presse wrote a story on that with the headline, "Tiananmen bloodbath-fueled economic boom," says Jiang. Now, that's the trade-offs hypothesis. Now, to some extent, any normative theory of legitimacy allows for trade-offs within certain limits. And it is true that poor countries are generally afforded greater margins of appreciation for focusing on developmental rights or subsistence rights compared to civil and political liberties. And there is some evidence that there is a belief in a trade-off among China's people, but only slightly. And the best evidence we have is, as I said, several years out of date already. So I don't think the trade-offs argument, although it's often made, really explains what's going on, which kind of leaves us with, by process of elimination, with what I call simply the performance hypothesis. And this is sort of a series of negatives, which I've just ruled out. A, the Chinese people are not afraid to speak their minds. They do not conceive of human rights differently than people in other places in the world. They do not lower their expectations of the state in light of historical or economic legacies, nor do they consider repression of basic rights as a necessary trade-off for performance. Rather, the simple answer is that China's people value other types of performance, such as economic development, the picture of Nanjing Road, great power, prestige, the picture of Hu Jintao meeting Bush, and growing social freedoms, a picture of rabid soccer fans in Beijing. And then when they're asked to make an all-things-considered evaluation of the regime, they give it a fairly high rating in spite of its bad performance on rights. Wang Zhengshu of the University of Michigan has called this the before critical citizens hypothesis. And it argues the Chinese people simply have not reached that inflection point at which they will start to put a higher weighting on rights in their overall evaluation of the regime. Now, if that's the empirical story, what's the normative story? Which is to say, okay, that's what they think. Is that defensible? I think this is an interesting question because it sort of takes us into the question of how widely we want to define the boundaries of an acceptable human rights record or an acceptable regime. I'm not a philosopher, but I've read a lot of philosophy, and I hope you have too. So let me borrow the philosophy of John Rawls on the question of legitimacy. In his book, The Law of Peoples, Rawls sets out two conditions for what an illiberal regime needs to be minimally decent, what he called. One is that it protected what he called urgent rights. Urgent rights were a much smaller subset of the whole range of liberal rights. And it was things like protection from physical harm, minimal amounts of private and social freedoms, but certainly didn't include the full gamut of liberal human rights, which the international human rights regime articulates. Now, to take various indicators, for example, the political terror scale put together at University of North Carolina gives China a rating of 4 out of 5. So not the worst rating, but almost the worst rating. And the reason it's only a 4 and not a 5 is that political imprisonments, for example, being jailed without trial are limited to those who involve themselves in oppositional politics. In the Freedom House Civil Liberties ratings, China is a 6, which is on a 7-point scale, it's the second from worst. And it's a 6 because, despite widespread political oppression, the private realm is seen as having gained in freedom, or at least maintained its freedom since Tiananmen. And there have been notable gains in China since Tiananmen in areas like subsistence, poverty reduction, educational improvements, life expectancy improvements, protest rights, actually. 87,000 people protesting, I'd say, is an indication of enhanced political freedoms in China. Travel, privacy, private property, the availability of the internet, et cetera. So does it pass the urgent rights condition? I'd say yes, but just barely. And I'm certainly willing to be convinced otherwise. Second condition was, is there a consultative political system? Now, Rawls put this in because he wanted to make sure that where there were these sorts of regimes with barely adequate rights records, that rights record in some way was a reflection of popular preferences. Now, I've already given you some data on what popular preferences are, which is the regime seems quite legitimate. But the consultative system idea was, let's make sure there's a system in place for getting feedback from people, and in some ways trying to respond to what he called a common good idea of justice. You can look at many data sets. One of them, for example, is the Polity 4 data set, which has an indicator called executive constraint, which is the extent to which executive government in the state is constrained by various social groups or other power groups, such that it has to respond to either the masses or politically salient groups. And I would say, again, in light of institutional change, especially in the last 5 years, and China is really kind of on fire with institutional change at the local level right now, public hearings, deliberative polling, popular nomination of candidates for people's congresses and even for the party committees of local places, and 87,000 protests going on. So I would say, again, a minimal pass. But again, I'm willing to be convinced otherwise. This is not an easy question. And for me, the two conditions that mitigate this in particular are, one, that subjectively the regime is highly legitimate. I think that's a mitigating factor. And two, I do disagree with Brad on this. I think things have got better. I think what's got worse, or what's become more prominent, is the Chinese government's desperate attempts to claw back the social freedoms and the rising political participation that is resulting from socioeconomic development. But I think that's a sign more of how they're failing rather than how they're succeeding. But a lot depends on this question. And I, as I say, I'm not wedded to the concept that it passes these two conditions. So, four conclusions. First of all, regime legitimacy depends on sustaining non-rights performance. That's what's keeping that regime in power right now. Two, I would say it's normatively legitimate, which is it just barely passes Rawls' two conditions. Legitimacy is not justice, of course. And I think there would be little debate that this is a deeply unjust regime. Thirdly, in light of the critical citizens hypothesis, which is people's weightings on human rights in their overall evaluations of a regime tend to rise with economic development, we can expect the importance attached to human rights to rise among the Chinese people as the socioeconomic development continues, quite irrespective of that development itself, indeed really dependent on it, because it's developing. That's why the rights weighting will rise over time. And finally, following from that, the future stability of this regime really depends on its rights record and how that improves over time. For external actors, I think what is important is to work to level the playing field of public discourse in China so that this shift to a more rights-demanding critical citizens takes place sooner rather than later. I look forward to the day when China's democracy, because I think democracy is ultimately the best guarantee of the assurance of basic rights in any country. China, of course, was a participant, an important one, in the formulation of the UN Declaration on Human Rights in 1948, and I look forward to the day when it is again at the forefront of the world's human rights movement. Thank you.
I received an email from the Center for Study of Human Rights to come and join this panel to speak on this topic, China's human rights. And then this was followed by a phone call from Professor Connor Geertie from the center. And I think the first thing he said was on the phone was that, "I don't really expect you to know about human rights in China." And I thought that was very reassuring. And it's on that basis, really, I'm here. And as to why I was asked, I think you have to ask Professor Geertie. But basically, everyone just knows my qualifications. Then I sort of have three points to make. The first point is that I think this actually, two previous speakers have already mentioned this as well. I think the overall human rights situation in China basically is better rather than worse. And I think one important reason why it seems from outside China that somehow it's getting worse, and Bruce, in his presentation, used a sentence which I saw very interesting. He said, "China is looming as the Soviet Union of our times." But I think one important reason why that is so is that, in fact, there's more access to human rights information in China from the outside. So it's not as if, say, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, there were less incidents of human rights violation in China. But today, I mean, these things do get picked up by the outside world very quickly. So therefore, I think you have this impression, because you constantly hear of these cases of individual human rights violation. So people get this impression that somehow the situation is really dire in China. And I think a very good recent example is, I think some on the border with Nepal, recently it was reported Chinese border guards shot at some Tibetans who tried to cross the border. And apparently the reason the world sort of all learned about this and reported was because there were some Western mountaineers who were in that area, and they had the video, so they made a video of that. So that I think that's a very good example of things happening in China. Immediately they get noticed. So that creates the impression. So basically, I think overall, as I said, I think the human rights situation is actually better rather than worse. And there are many reasons for me to make that statement. I think one important positive change is that over the years we have seen more laws that have been adopted to protect human rights. For example, the protection of human rights was written into the Chinese constitution. It was a couple of years ago. And we have new laws in the basically the past 10, 20 years. For example, at the moment we have this administrative procedure law, which basically allows individuals to sue a government agency or government officials for violations of law and for violation of their rights. But this law only came into effect in 1990. So before 1990, there's no legal provision for anyone who has, you know, been abused by government officials or suffered unfair treatment from the government to actually even challenge that. And we also know that the criminal procedure law, which was revised in 1996, and at the moment it's sort of under discussion for further revision, and basically that provides better protection of criminals, of civil people's rights. So we do have these positive developments in terms of legislation. And secondly, I think the reason that overall situation is better is because people's awareness of their rights has increased tremendously. This professor in the US, Kevin O'Brien, developed this concept of rightful resistance. It's basically talking about individual citizens, peasants. They sort of nowadays, when they try to sort of challenge government policy or practice, they sort of they're more aware of their rights and they're able to refer to sort of the laws that stipulate that they have these rights. So he developed this concept of rightful resistance. To analyze the phenomenon of increasing people's increasing awareness of their rights. And I recently did some research in China on this phenomenon called public interest litigation. And this is a sort of phenomenon that's it's kind of a phenomenon that has developed in China for a few years, but I think has not attracted enough attention outside China. And it's basically public interest litigation that's opposed to private interest litigation. That's basically individuals who bring a lawsuit and supposedly sort of through that lawsuit to help to promote, sort of protect public interest or sort of defend interest not just for one individual but for many people. So there are many very interesting cases in recent years of these public interest litigation. So I'll just give you a few examples. For example, in 2005, a student sued the Ministry of Personnel in China for discrimination based on a person's age. This person, the student, was barred from taking the civil service exam because he was over the age of 35. Because they had an age limit in order to, if you want to become a civil servant, to take them, you have to be under 35. So this was challenged by people, thinking that was discrimination based on age. And also in 2005, there was this case of two lawyers in Henan province. They sued a police station in Shenzhen for defamation. And that was basically... this police station in Shenzhen, it's for pandering to popular prejudice against people of Henan origin. The police station, they put out a banner which read, resolutely cracked down on Henan racketeer gangs. So basically, the lawyers challenged that and said there was discrimination based on people's birthplace because it's popular prejudice, people from Henan are more likely to engage in criminal activity, so the police put out a banner, and that was challenged, so the police had to issue an apology. And we also have cases recently involving a farmer who sued the local finance bureau because he noted that they bought two expensive cars. So this farmer sued the finance bureau as a taxpayer, questioning because they're using government budget and that money comes from taxpayer. So he basically questioned their right to buy these expensive cars. And we even have cases like two teachers in, university teachers in Nanjing, the capital city of Jiangsu province. they sued the Nanjing Municipal Urban Planning Bureau for erecting a viewing platform at a mountain resort. So the challenge, the teachers who challenged that decision said it spoiled the spiritual enjoyment they gained from enjoying the natural scenery. So we have all these many cases of individuals bringing these lawsuits in order to defend public interest. That's a very good indication of the increasing awareness of people's rights. And also, I think overall, the government is the Chinese government is also more willing to respond to human rights accusations these days. I found a very interesting example, which was I think at the end of last year, somehow the European Parliament got interested in sort of animal rights issues in China. They apparently passed a resolution demanding China to ban the farming of bears for bio. This is bear's bile, which is considered a very effective medicine in Chinese medicine. So there are these farms where they keep these bears and it sort of take the bios from. And this got a lot of attention, and the European Parliament sort of expressed opinion. And then the Chinese government immediately organized a press conference, a central government, to explain China's effort to improve animal welfare. So that's a very good example, not just human rights, but also animal welfare. It's something that government feels it needs to respond very quickly. So anyway, these are just examples of this to sort of highlight this point, which is, I think, overall, the situation is getting better. And my second point is that I think human rights situation in China is very closely linked to other issues, in particular the rule of law and good governance. So eventually, I think a high level of respect for and protection of human rights can only be achieved if there is also substantial progress being made in political, economic, and social spheres. I think it really depends on improvements in education, healthcare, social welfare, all these things, income distribution, gender equality, and so on and so forth. Currently, there are many incidents of human rights violation which are not the result of national government policies which restrict freedom of human rights, although, I mean, these cases do exist. But I think probably even more incidents of human rights violation are actually caused because existing laws and existing policies which look good on paper are actually not implemented. So, for example, I think these issues were already mentioned by Brett, or these illegal seizure of land from farmers, these is the illegal eviction in urban areas to make way for civil real estate development. We have all these reports of, again, miners. Many miners die every year in these mining accidents. And again, many of these are illegal mines, which they're not because there's a policy allowing them, but rather because they break the laws and continue to operate. And we also have all these sweatshops where industrial workers are exploited without any health and safety provision. And again, it's not because China didn't have labor laws, but often these laws are violated. So there are many these examples. I think a lot of the problem, it comes down to the state's lack of a capacity to implement laws and to provide a proper sort of a social welfare and for its population. It's not because the state is actively impose restrictions on human rights. So that is in itself a problem. But what I'm saying is there are even more problems which are caused not because there are these laws and restrictions, but because laws that protect human rights are not properly enforced. And that has to do with limited state capacity and poor governance. So that's the second point I want to make. And certainly, I just want to sort of talk about the Western approach to human rights in China. And I have this criticism, which is outside attention tend to focus a lot on just a few individuals, a few cases which basically involve political dissidents. Or at least who sort of politicize their activities. And that tend to attract a lot of media attention outside China. But many of these cases, they actually lack resonance with ordinary Chinese people. I think recently there are a few very high-profile cases. Brett mentioned one involving Chen Guangcheng, the blind sub-activist. There's also one case which also attracted a lot of attention with this lawyer called Gao Zhisheng, who was arrested. And I was in Beijing at the time when he was arrested, and I sort of a joint discussion of some people who were his friends and who were sort of fellow political dissidents. So there was a discussion about, you know, what to do, why he was arrested. And even these people who consider themselves his sub-comrades accept that basically he was engaged in all these outright political activities. So he was writing these polemics, attacking the Communist Party and that sort of thing. So some people was kind of criticizing him, saying, looking at his past trajectory, saying, you know, he started with sort of defending human rights, but increasingly devoting more and more attention, instead of dealing with these individual cases, become sort of turned himself into focusing solely on sort of these political issues and political sort of attacks. And I was also involved in discussion with some other people. Again, I mean, these people have... I mean, they're basically friends of these activists. And there is this feeling that some people got into trouble not because their work in to defend human rights, but always because then they stray into this political fight. So with some of these people, there was a speculation. It was not so much their sort of activism to protect human rights, but then they became they took part in hunger strikes and so writing these things of attacking the communist government. Anyway, this is not my analysis. I was listening to the discussion of their friends. So I think but that's the reason. But the reason they sort of got into that was because that's a way to guarantee that you get more attention from outside China, from international media. If you're merely sort of working there to, you know, help HIV/AIDS victims or things like, you don't get as much attention as when you, you know, constantly publish these polemics on the internet, attacking the Communist Party. So, and these people in the discussion, they were saying. Probably not many Chinese people have actually ever heard of these individuals, even though they're sort of so well known outside China. So I think that is sort of my feeling, which is there's too much attention focused on these few individuals because they sort of get into this political attack on the Communist Party. And I sort of question whether that is the most effective way to help improve human rights on the ground in China. I think, as I sort of mentioned earlier, with all these cases, individual people who are maybe apolitical, but they nevertheless suffer injustice in their daily lives, and it results from a variety of factors, you know, or bad policies, unfair policies, incompetent government administration, corruption, flawed decision making, and inadequate social welfare provision, lack of access to information, and so on and so forth. But sort of the Western attention or outside sort of attention is often not focused on these issues. And I think because the sort of criticism from outside tend to be too narrow and sort of focusing on these political cases. And so very often, very quickly turn into some sort of attack on the political system. As a result, I think the Chinese government then gets the Chinese government more alarmed. And it's not necessarily conducive to actually helping improve the situation on the ground, because when it's constantly under attack, the Chinese government, developed this deep distrust of the motives of foreign organizations, individuals who try to help improve human rights, and always suspect they have some sort of political motivation, trying to sort of undermine China's image and things like that. And they may then put more effort into the restricting information on human rights situation in China. So this will only make it more difficult for the international community to sort of help to bring positive change. So on other occasion, I've sort of put forward this proposal that a lot of the problems that ordinary people sort of suffer, and Brett also mentioned this, I mean, you would talk about these peasants, ordinary peasants and workers. So I feel human rights is certainly one way of addressing these issues, but there are also other alternative concepts which can also be used. Like, for example, the rule of law, which is basically essential if you want to improve human rights. But that is seemed to be a more acceptable way of addressing the issue. When you raise it with Chinese government, instead of saying, I want to sort of talk to you about human rights, if you say we need to sort of talk about rule of law, which is also the avowed priority of the Chinese government itself. So I think that might sort of leave people more space to address these issues. There are also other concepts like, you know, social justice, equality, and, you know, disadvantaged and vulnerable social groups. There's a better protection for these people. I mean, there are these Chinese official policy priorities and jargons like harmonious society, and I think the human rights campaign can make better use of these sort of concepts in order to pursue their cause. So in conclusion, basically, this kind of linked to my second point, which was human rights. You cannot be considered in isolation as the overall improvement in governance and rule of law and all these of social welfare are sort of all interlinked. So I think the approach will be also to look at all those other aspects, areas as well, in order to help improve human rights. Thank you.
We have time for questions, and before you all disappear because it's late, after questions we have a reception to which you are all invited, as long as you behave while we have this period of questions. You've seen me at my most liberal, allowing people to define their own 15 minutes. We all were a bit excessive, I think, including me. But with questions, I'm going to be quite tough on you. I'd like you to say who you are and where you come from. Keep your questions short, and I'll take them in groups. So I'll take four or five questions, and then the panel will give you a response. There are roving microphones, so if you could please indicate that you want to ask a question. Right. Start downstairs first. Here, first.
You're going to take five?
Yes, I am. I'm going to take groups of five.
Thank you so much. I want to...
No, who are you? Sorry, is going to be done properly.
Yeah.
Who are you and where from?
My name is Herping Li, yeah, from China. I just want to ask one very concerning question, because I personally, I was detained in a forced labor camp for 2 years in a Chinese labor camp. And I want to know, yeah, how, like Ms. Yi Lu, yeah, how you can address the situation in labor camp. As I know, when even some investigators were visiting this labor camp, and then all the policemen will, you know, decorate all the labor camp or even wash the clothes of the forced laborers. And in this kind of situation, how could people outside China investigate very properly? And
can we keep them quite short?
Okay. And the second is just a question. Did Ms. Yi Lu really convince yourself about your conclusion about Chinese human rights? Because it's really difficult. Like myself, before I was sent to a labor camp, I can't believe what will happen in this kind of labor camp. And only after that, I can know, yeah, it's really different than I expected. So that's all my questions. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to take a few more, and then we'll answer them in a group. You need a microphone, yes.
Okay, can you hear me?
Just.
Is it on?
Yes, that's right. That's good.
Okay, my name is Amina. I'm actually half Tibetan. I would like to ask two questions. First, Mrs. Yu, Liu, sorry. I don't really understand why you differentiate so much between human rights and the political, because as far as I understand, first-generation human rights are actually the political rights, and I don't really see what animal rights or landscapes have to do with human rights. Secondly, Mr. Gilley, did I pronounce that right? Sorry. Concerning your five hypotheses, the first one, fear, you concluded on the fact that that more or less people are allowed to say what they want. I have to say I totally disagree with that. First of all, one example is I was in Shanghai this summer, and there was a book about I Ching, and someone suggested to this Chinese girl she should read it because it's really interesting. And she said, oh, actually, I'd rather not because it would confuse me. That's a typical answer that you'd get of a Chinese person who's been totally brainwashed. And the second thing is also, it's true, it's a fact. I actually experienced that. And the other thing is, talking about Tibet, I mean, I find it really ridiculous that you could say that people are allowed to say what they actually believe, because it's just not right. It's just not, doesn't, it's not correct.
Here, also at the front.
Hello. Because today's topic is a debate, so I want to make a very, very brief comment to Mr. Adams.
Sorry, I didn't get
Adams.
Your name.
And when we see that people...
Excuse me.
What?
I didn't get your name.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. I'm Marbo. I'm from Department of Government. I'm a postgraduate student here. And when you say that... China is a developing country and not democratic country, then some phenomena you list will be inherited in the system and the society. And I was from Beijing Normal University, and I want frankly to you that I know most of the phenomena you list, because not from the, maybe not because I'm here, so I know that I can get a resource from the internet and Economist magazine or Times magazine in my school. So I'm thinking is that maybe you should give more analysis and more suggestion rather than only criticizing the human right record, because maybe the next speaker can list the 100 record that China have a good human record. So it won't be the meaningless. So I think maybe you are a graduate from LSE, and I think maybe you can think about our motto is that to know the course of things. That's my personal opinion. Thank you.
Okay, one more, and then we'll give the speakers a go. So here.
My name is Yuli. I'm a journalism student from Goldsmith College. Talking about Tibet, I'm really interested in the human rights situation there. If any of you, three of you, know like the recent situation of human rights in Tibet in the last 20 years, it would be great if you can tell me a bit more about that. Second question is for Mr. Adams. I'm wondering, do you think that the A China that you have mentioned about would have a positive influence on the B China? And the human rights situation in China in general? And the third question, which is also a very brief one, is that could you, any of you, please compare the case of the like Al Jazeera journalists or the British Muslims who are captured, who are sent to Guantanamo Bay, and compare it to any of the dissidents jailed or attacked in China? Could you please compare these two cases, and do you think there are anything which would only happen in the case of China? Please. Thank you.
I know they're quite brief questions, but the answers are likely to be incredibly long, so I'm probably going to get you to pursue these people at the reception afterwards to get a very long answer, because there are a lot of people who want to ask questions. So I wonder if the speakers could just give a comment rather than a very full answer to, especially to the last lot of questions, and then we can have more questions, because otherwise the balance is inappropriate. So, Lily, you really got a lot of questions.
It is on. Okay. Very briefly, I think the point I was making was basically compared with its own past, its overall human rights situation in China is better. I'm not saying it's great. So I think the first question, someone's the re-education through labor camp, it's not as if it was not there 5 years ago, 10 years ago. It has always been there. So that's the whole point. I'm not trying to say it's good. I'm just saying overall it's actually even better. And before, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, it's even worse. So, but somehow in the popular perception, it's really bad just because 20 years ago you didn't get this much information on it. So that's the whole point I was trying to make. In terms of how you change that, again, in my second point, I think I was trying to say it's hard to imagine, you know, with all these other problems like governance and the rule of law, so the still the democracy, all this tremendous problem there, and somehow human rights it alone improves greatly. So I think it's sort of a part parcel of the whole sort of a system which needs to be further improved. So again, that's just my point. I'm not saying somehow because of that, that then it's fine. I'm just saying it's a very difficult thing. You can't just prove human rights alone. You have to work on other things as well. And the second question, I think, was also sort of political rights. I think those examples I gave was basically talking about in general, this growing awareness of their rights among Chinese people. So these examples didn't matter. Some of these did not involve as political rights, but that is still an example to show that people has this growing awareness of rights. Maybe it's not political rights, but nevertheless, it's some sort of right, and people are aware of that. I think.
So quickly, I didn't say there was free speech in China. I said that responses to survey questions in controlled situations are accurate, and that's a different thing. And I think that's, I don't think there's much dispute about that. And of course, if you meet Chinese citizens outside of China in situations where you would expect they have very little fear of retribution, I think you'll generally get positive responses. So I take that as quite accurate reading. Comparing to Guantanamo, well, there's 500 people in Guantanamo, roughly, with access to lawyers, with access to human rights, to amnesty, to the Red Cross, and with some form of trials for them. There are 500,000 people in labor camps in China, no access to the Red Cross or to amnesty, no lawyers, no trials, and probably not much future. So I don't really think they can be compared.
Okay, very briefly, someone asked about how to investigate forced labor camps, which is extremely difficult, and I think that people should realize what the risks are that people take who engage in human rights investigations and monitoring in China are. Those risks are enormous. For us to put together a report on something like this takes really tremendous courage and bravery from people inside China to help filter information back to us. One thing I can say very clearly is we can't do it ourselves. There's no way that outside human rights investigators can go into forced labor camps or gather the information on our own. We would simply be thrown out of the country or arrested if we did so. And also, I just want to, I guess, same point. You cannot, people can dismiss the human rights community there as political or too activist or marginal. You cannot overstate the fear in which human rights activists are doing their work these days. There's an enormous sense of fear. And when I talked about trajectory earlier, that fear is much greater than it was even a couple of years ago. And all governments who work on Chinese human rights from outside agree at that point. There is sort of an odd point suggested by Yi that somehow taking up political causes is illegitimate. If you only stuck as an activist to legitimate causes, you could have our sympathy. I think that's a very dangerous point and an extremely slippery slope. The one thing I would say is that most people, if you talk to them about their own personal experiences, started out not trying to get, trying actually consciously to not get into politics. They didn't want to become political activists. And they were drawn into it by what they saw. And they were drawn into it by the system. I know someone named Wan Yan Hai who works on HIV/AIDS, who was purely interested in addressing the epidemic, who became a political activist because he was arrested for speaking out on HIV/AIDS. Never dreamed he would become a well-known international activist. And the idea that people do this to draw attention to themselves, I think, is really a dangerous concept. And I don't think that should be suggested. There may be people... I mean, there may be people who have that motive. They want to become public and they want to become famous. But that's not who most of these people are. And if you know them, you'll know that to be the case. And I do think that the question of freedom of expression really is a question of the private and public sphere. I think actually that's the line that one should draw. In the private sphere, the space for free expression is enormously greater than it used to be. However, there are parts of the country, such as Tibet, where that's still not the case. That is not the case in Tibet. People are very afraid, for instance, to express support for the Dalai Lama. If they do so, they can see the inside of a prison very quickly. So these things shouldn't be confused. Even if there's a generally larger space for public debate, it is still very, very controlled. And then just very quickly on Guantanamo, I would just have a slightly different take. I mean, Guantanamo is a travesty. People don't have access to lawyers, generally. They don't have access to trials. There's a whole discussion in the United States about whether there are going to be trials. The United States Congress passed an infamous law 2 weeks ago doing away with habeas corpus rights for people who are in Guantanamo. So I wouldn't want to compare. We stay out of comparisons. The 500,000 point is perfectly accurate. The state of Chinese prisons is deplorable. But I don't want to say anything good about Guantanamo. Guantanamo is a travesty.
We aren't going to get everyone able to ask the questions they want to ask, but I can give the other side of the lecture theatre a go, and then we'll probably have to close it down. So if you want to be pointed at, wave your hand. So one here in the middle, one up at the front here, one there, and then I think down here. That'll probably do us, I think. So. Keep them brief.
My name is Colby. I'm from Santa Barbara, California. And this is a question directed at Mr. Adams. He mentioned, or you mentioned, Google and Yahoo going into China and voluntarily making compromises to their search engines. And I wanted you to respond. And I would argue that any sort of access to any information is a positive change. So if they were presented with the option to come in, they have to make compromises, I would say that's a good thing, a promotion of human rights, rather than saying we don't want to come in at all if we have to make any sort of compromises. So I wanted you to respond to that.
Here at the front.
Wait. Hello, thank you. My name is Deng Chunzu. I'm from China, but I left China since I was young. I just got a bit confused about Mr. Brand Adams' conclusions. You said like the only way to improve Chinese human rights is the international press or expert press. You said that you get this conclusion from you talking with your friends or you talking some Chinese problem experts. But I'm wondering, the foreign or international organization, they will really in the stand of the Chinese people, or they will more or less considering about the economics factors, like the UBS, or you mentioned like the Google things in China. Thank you.
And then upstairs here.
Hi, my name is Simon. I'm studying human rights here at LSE. I have questions.
Louder.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. I have a question to Mr. Adams. I'm just interested, how far-reaching is the influence of international human rights organizations, and what are the problems that you're facing in human rights monitoring work? And another question is about the possibility of creating human rights monitoring, regional human rights monitoring system in Asia, and what is your view about this possible mechanism? Thank you.
And then just want, down here, last one.
Hi, my name is Susan. I'm in the MSc Human Rights Program here at LSC, and I'm from Vancouver, Canada. I have an opinion question for the panel. How much do you think international opinion, and not, you know, action by foreign governments or diplomatic measures, but actual opinion, you know, the worldwide protests about the Falun Gong atrocities, stuff like that, how much does it matter to the government in China? Does it really influence policy?
Okay, can we... Brad, you've got quite a lot of those questions directed at you, so I'm giving you about 30 seconds to answer all of them, even if the answer is I'll go upstairs and engage in the discussion. But I wonder if we can go in the order that you spoke, sort of 30 seconds each, to sum up and try and answer those questions. Test.
30 seconds each question? Or
no, each.
All
try.
Yeah. Okay. Google and Yahoo, basically, there's no question through testing that Google gives more information than analogous Chinese search engines. Yahoo gives about the same. The question we have for the companies is, why are you doing things unilaterally? Unless you're ordered, you shouldn't do it. And second, you can do more. That's my short answer. They can all do more, and they should do more. I didn't understand. I apologize. I didn't understand the second question. The influence of international human rights organizations, how to do monitoring, I'll tell you a very short point, which is that nothing has harmed the international human rights effort more than the Bush administration policies in the last 5 years. We have those thrown back in our face every day all over the world. We're told that the new standard is Guantanamo when it comes to preventive detention laws or prison conditions, or when it comes to counterterror measures, it's what the U.S. is doing. We have countries like the Chinese in Xinjiang, the Malaysians, the Singaporeans, the Pakistanis, all of them feeding that back to us. It makes it very, very difficult. And the last one, how much does international opinion matter? And this is a corollary to someone else's question. Look, the Chinese people are telling us that without international pressure, whatever they do domestically won't matter. So it's not that international pressure alone matters. It's not that international pressure alone is the answer. It's that it creates space for Chinese people to stand up for their rights. Without that space, they have, in their views, no chance.
The question of a regional grouping is very important, not just institutionally, but I think politically. I think one of the, in addition to the Bush administration's effect on human rights advocacy in China, one of the other problems is the failure of Asian countries, liberal democracies in Asia, to stand up for human rights in China. And I think the only lead is really being taken by Taiwan right now. Protest matters. Yeah, it matters not just in the way Brad suggested, but it helps to educate Chinese officials in free societies and how they operate. I'm very familiar with the Canadian case and the Falun Gong protesters there, and the embassy keeps telling our government, can you just arrest them, please? And the government says, no, we can't do that. And they say, yes, we understand. Can you please arrest them? No, we really can't do that in a free society. So I think it's quite educative for them.
I sort of agree. I think the international sort of opinion that plays an important part, but ultimately, things need to happen within in China, and largely need to be Chinese people themselves that work to improve human rights in China. And I think there are many people in China who sort of work on this, and they're activists no less, even though they don't attract as much attention as the few individuals that who have attracted a lot of attention. So, and I think, this is something which maybe so we should pay more attention to. And ultimately, it is Chinese people, as well, repeating myself, Chinese people themselves, they need to solve this problem.
I like these LSE panel discussions and debates because it's pretty clear that the panel could all say more, very much more. And it's also clear to me that all of you still have more questions that you would like answered. It's the nature of these evenings, isn't it? But you are all invited upstairs to the fifth floor for drinks, and if you can catch these people, then no doubt you will be able to continue the discussion. I've got a couple of other announcements to make. If you have been interested in tonight, outside were leaflets on the Centre for the Study of Human Rights, other events that are on, and the next one is a lunchtime event on Monday the 6th of November. It's a titled Field Notes, Human Rights Defenders Speak, and it's in conjunction with the Human Rights Watch UK. So please do come to that if you're interested. And then can I thank our panel? They've done a superb job.